sermon, if we came upon this verse, then should we panic and flee from the chair of delivery of that sermon? No. Because we have the power of the faith in what is being given by our Divine Master. And to help our friends, we must accordingly, praying for His grace, try to pass that on for the benefit of our friends. In this way, Jim, he presented himself very humbly. So much, so humble, how humble can we imagine, that he even addressed his disciples as Vipadodharana Bandhugam. He addressed his disciples not as anything demeaning, as anyone inferior, not as a bearded man ready to throw down thunderbolts at any moment. But he addressed them as my friends who've come to save me at my time of need. I'm on this path back to the divine transcendental world. And now so many friends have come searching for that transcendental world. I cannot deceive them. I have to give what perception I have of that plane. And in so doing, I shall draw the grace of my Lord. Not only unto them, but unto myself. So you are so dear to me. You are so gracious to me. And we find this to be the highest representation in the heart of the teacher. We can understand it more simply and naturally in our common everyday dealings. What does the father think about his son? The child is father of the man. It's always like that. The dutiful parents always have their children. Their children show them revolutionary things that they couldn't have dreamed of. And similarly, the true teachers present themselves with that simplicity, that humility, that touches our hearts and takes us to the upper world. By speaking these words, I pray not to cast an aspersion of underestimation upon the exalted position of Gurudev, because we did recall a couple of minutes ago that Krishna himself says, I am that Gurudev. Jai Guru Maharaj. So you've kindly given me your attentive hearing, and it's my prayer that if anyone has any questions relevant to these matters, you can kindly put them to Sri Padmanabhan Maharaj. And if he will bless us, he can answer those questions. Oh, if he orders me, I can also remain in the fray. Srila Guru Maharaj is still going to be with us for a couple more days over at Mulwillimbah, even though by his grace he couldn't come this evening. But we don't fly out until Tuesday morning. So if anyone feels the disappointment of not having his association tonight, please don't feel that. And come on over there. We've got another day or so.
Any questions? That was a question. Maharaj, he mentioned separating the wheat from the chaff. It's a very good idea. actually. Because we've heard, we've all heard that the wheat shall inherit the earth. So I'm interested in that.
So that's some grits and meat.
Just a little bit of meat. I see. All right. But anyway, along that line, you mentioned about the idea of between the religion of common people is that of fear, and the religion of the saints is different. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he talks about that point in his essay on the Bhagava. He says that the religion of the masses, of general people, is that of fear. There is, and we've also heard, that shouldn't surprise us. There's a saying that says that even the devil himself, he quotes scripture. You heard that saying, something to that effect, huh? You know, he can present himself as a theist in some veiled kind of way. He had that former paper, papers from Spanish, but in the former role he had that of fallen angel or whatever, as far as mythology goes, right? And his saying was that it's better to reign in hell than to serve in heaven. That kind of idea. So the religion of fear, people think that the whole concept of the universe revolves around that egocentric idea. And that's why is it that people think that way, or is that a very negative view that we're taking, an unfair view if we say that? Well, the whole idea of most people is that they think that everything revolves upon this body and mind. That as long as this body and the mind is satisfied, that will be their happiness. And most people think in order to, even if they're a little bit enlightened, what they think in order to achieve their goals is that they have to bring different kinds of sensations and different kinds of objects into themselves to be consumed or to be utilized by them. And if you doubt me in that respect, just turn on the television. You know, because that's good. I thought it was something very interesting. When Govinda Maharaj, San Jose, he turned on the TV. Not only turned on the TV, but he turned it on practically at full volume. He was sitting there and pumped up the volume, as we say. Everything going really loud, was changing channels, and watching attentively, especially the commercials, you know, when they're selling the different products. And you can see, there's a person who, I mean, they have television in India, but it's of a little different scale. I mean, you know, you get the mood. If you go to, for instance, Jagannath Puri, when the ladies go to Jagannath Puri with their chaperones or company, if they go in the water, they go in, you know, completely clothed, with saris, etc. So that would give an indication that there's something different in Indian television than maybe in American television, although maybe they're practicing now, I don't know. But anyway, Maharaj was watching the television, and he made an observation. He said, what's really happening on this television is the commercials. Everything else changes and is incidental. But what's really important on the television, what's of the most, you know, the most thought and the most, you know, preparation is the commercials. And that's what we would expect, because maybe we could say 50 years ago or something like that, what we were living in was maybe, what people were living in was, you could say 50 years ago, 100 years ago, the Industrial Revolution. But today, except for maybe the Third World, people don't live in the Industrial Revolution. What they live in is consumer revolution, you might say. The values of society, the values of people and everything change according to the manipulation of big business, or, you know, what motivates people to spend their money. And that's of interest, you know. You wanted to say something?
Your colleague before mentioned the six enemies, and I wondered if you could go over the names in English and in Sanskrit, and tell me why they mentioned in that order.
I can't make it out.
I mentioned about the six enemies, and if you could repeat them in English
and
in Sanskrit.
And why they mentioned in that particular order.
And why they mentioned in that particular order.
And how.
Okay, but can I get there a little bit later? I'll get there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll get there. Since that's a question, I should take it, but I want to go on a little bit from where I was at. And I was saying...
Just finish your point.
My point's just starting. You know, it's like the man... Anyway. So Maharaj was watching the television, and what he was saying is, what's really happening here, it's the commercials. Everything else, the news, the soap operas, the situation comedies, and everything else that's going on television is just, you know, reorganized around the commercials. And that's true. That's really what funds things. That's really what keeps things going. That's really what makes and breaks, you know, a lot of political things that are going on. And anyway, I'm digressing a little bit, but what I was saying is that relates to the fact that people are bringing objects of this world into their own senses in order to be able to use them, to enjoy them. And that's what we call exploitation. That's the general level, even if it's... And another level is that of the mind, or the level of knowledge. But both of those levels are negative. Neither one of them involve giving. Everything that people are using is to take things in for themselves. They're absorbing rather than giving. We always hear about the spirit of giving, but as long as we exist in a completely body and mind, body or mental frame of reference, there is no question of giving, because everyone thinks that everything that's going on in the world is ultimately meant for them. And that's generally what is the conception of most people. So with that idea, we can say the religion of the masses is that of fear, because the only thing that will break them momentarily out of this, you know, this complete fixation with that conception of life, or maybe even goes along with it, is that somebody will put, you know, the quote fear of God into them. And you'll get some harangue or diatribe going on, maybe in the church or on television. And Bhaktivinoda Thakura says that is the religion of the masses. But the religion of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and that of the saints is different. What they come is to give love of God, love of Godhead. That is the real pursuit of people. And not only they come, but also we find those who are the most, you know, prone to give that are what Bhaktivinoda Thakur refers to as reformists. He says that they can take an old or conventional thought, or a thought, maybe something was very revolutionary sometime before, and now it has become banal, or just very utilized. I happen to live, a lot of the time I live in Mexico. So I know that there, the ruling government, it's called pre-word, which is, goes back to the turn of the century, the beginning of the 20th century, when they were the party of the revolution. But now they're not the party of the revolution. They represent, you know, they've won every election for the last 100 years or 80 years, like that. So there are a lot of times when we see that an idea was revolutionary in its time, but now it's just become, you know, very dated. So certainly we would say in the line of reformists, there have been great reformists in history, great revolutionaries in the idea of spiritual thought. Mahaprabhu was one. Then you can say in different religious traditions there were also reformists, like Christ, like Muhammad, these kind of personalities. And as I said, their religion is that of love of Godhead, not fear of God. We find, and we've had that relationship with Srila Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, that he was certainly such a reformist. And you could see he was a reformist and a revolutionary by the fact that he made so many innovations, which are those which are very distinct, and those are representative of a true acharya or true spiritual leader. He was of that kind of quality. He changed many things, and because of that, there was great upheaval. Not only there was, first of all, among the followers of Mahaprabhu in India, many people objected to many things that he did. That, for instance, that he integrated men and women within a spiritual society. That was objected. Changing the traditional role of ladies within the spiritual society, that they were joining in the kirtan and the chanting and dancing. That was objected to. And the style of preaching that he introduced was different. Before, monks were going out. But he introduced also that married men and their wives, their families, participated in the preaching. That was somewhat revolutionary. He was a reformist. But the greatest revolution that we see is that what he came to give in the West, and then also that spread back to India. That revolution being that he wasn't just taking some tired old concept of fear of God and trying to, you know, give somebody a fire and brimstone speech, but he actually spoke of bhakti, which is the real religion of the soul, and presenting that as something living and giving us the really third plane of existence, which is that of dedication, which is giving, and which is 24 hours a day. He gave that, and people responded. But we have seen, since the passing away of Srila Prabhupada in 1977, November, that not everyone could carry and continue with that same spirit of revolution, reform, of breathing life into what is a living process, which is devotion. And therefore we say that, as Maharaj is indicating, who really can do that is the saint, the real Vaishnava. He has that capacity. And we find that capacity in the persons of Srila Bhakti Rakak Sridharadev Goswami Maharaj. Many people can say that, oh, he was not known. He never came to Australia. He never went to America. He never went to England. And yet, as the saying goes, that if Muhammad won't go to the mountain will come to Muhammad. And the world came to his balcony in that beautiful place of Srinavadip Dham. In West Bengal, the world came to his veranda, where he would sit and they would hear from him and what he gave. What he gave and what we are publishing, what is living, what is going on in so many books, and what Srila Govindamaharaj also speaks so clearly, is that same continuation of something very real and really vital. We are not interested in just the rituals of the body. We are not interested, just as the devil may be able to quote scripture, so also a process which deals with only rituals is of absolutely no interest or value. I can say that because, for instance, Srila Guru Maharaj, Srila Bhakti Rakak Sridhardeva Goswami Maharaj, and one point of the Golden Volcano, I thought there was a very interesting thing. He says that, in Bengal, at a time when, he says that the society at the time when Mahaprabhu came was a society of what was it, the worship of the marriage of cats. Do you remember that place? Was a society of worship of cats. And I thought,
they'd spend money like water on the marriage of cats.
I thought, what is that? Spending money like water on the marriage of cats. But actually, that has something to do with what is normal traditional religion. People get really worked up about marriages. You know, for instance, in India, we see people, they really can spend money on a marriage. And that becomes things like marriages, births, things like that, that becomes of excitement. Also in the West, I've seen, if you open up any country, you open up the society page or something like that, you just see all these marriages going on, and, churches or keeps them in business. So, but that marriage of cats, society of the marriage of cats, Mahaprabhu came and changed that. And, we find that after Srila Prabhupada left, people became, as the devotees got older, as they became married, as their children grew up, then they had considerations of who would do this, who would do that, who would be the performing priest, whatever. But really the spirit which Srila Prabhupada came to give, that is a living faith. And Srila Guru Maharaj, he didn't leave Navadvip, but he is really the inspiration of countless unborn saints. He is the spirit of Mahaprabhu, and we can say more than the spirit of Mahaprabhu, the spirit of the Rupanuga Sampradaya was given by his spiritual master, Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, to him. He was known as Shastra Nipunja. He could correct the errors even of his god brothers. And such a person as Srila Guru Maharaj gave us the person of Srila Bhakti Sundar Govind Maharaj. That is his gift. And not just that gift, Guru Maharaj gave so much. And people don't realize really who Srila Guru Maharaj was and what he came to give. That even devotees, they cannot realize that. And yet, it doesn't, in one sense, doesn't matter if they realize or not, because it is etched in stone. It is there. And it will be appreciated. He is really that quality of person that we cannot imagine, of the stature of great Acharya. And not only he gave the world so much, he also gave Srila Govindamaharaj, who will continue to present that revolution really in devotion which Guru Maharaj began. That revolution has personalities like Srila Prabhupada, Srila Guru Maharaj, Srila Govinda Maharaj. And those who cannot appreciate that, I think that their misfortune is in changing a little bit the words of Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami, citing an adage. He says that it is like the logic of, what is it? The logic of a third of a hen.
You know, half a hen.
Well, in this case, third. You know, the logic of the half of a hen is that a man has a hen that will lay golden eggs. Huh? And his thinking is, oh, the half that gives the golden eggs, that's very nice. But the half that gobble, gobble, gobble is eating all my grains, that is just a waste of time feeding that half. It gives nothing. So why not separate this chicken in half? I'll keep the half that lays the golden eggs and throw away the half that is just eating the grains. But, of course, by dividing the chicken, no more golden eggs, nothing. Because that. So that is the logic of half a chicken. In this case, third of a chicken, because we're speaking of Guru Maharaj, Srila Prabhupada, and Srila Govinda Maharaj, you know, and their followers. And if anyone cannot appreciate that entire divine presence of these persons, then they're very much unfortunate. Because, as I mentioned before, and I don't want to get a little too much, what's the word, repetitive on that point, but just to see, Srila Prabhupada came, he was present in the Western world approximately 10 years. Many devotees didn't know him more than 5-6 years. Yet he transformed the face of this earth and gave so much. You know, but not everyone had his direct association. Not everyone appreciated who he was and what he had to say. Although they were adept, as Maharaj has indicated in joke on many occasions, of saying Prabhupada said this and Prabhupada did that and Prabhupada said this, and Maharaj has even written one song. You know, Prabhupada said and did this, but actually, what is the spirit of Prabhupada, you know, often gets lost in their stories because they're not Prabhupada. And so after 6 or 7 years, when Srila Prabhupada left this world, and at the ripe old age of 27 and 28, when they became, you know, world Jagat Gurus and everything, then we found that, you know, maybe the world was not ready for that. And a person of like Srila Guru Maharaj, who served as an inspiration for Srila Prabhupada himself, and an inspiration not only for Prabhupada, but for so many persons, so many of his godbrothers and for senior Vaishnavas. He has really something to give, and I would beg, you know, the devotees in general to try to address that or try to appreciate what is that real gift and see who is Guru Maharaj. For those who are new or just coming in contact with the line of Sri Chaitanya Saraswati, try to, you know, associate with the devotees, and I feel that in associating with them, you'll see that they have actually some view or vantage of what is the some of the really beautiful and golden precepts of Srila Guru Maharaj, which are really necessary for a continued growth in devotion. And Srila Govinda Maharaj, you know, he is in one sense his own person, his own individual, and a blend of ideas of Guru Maharaj and Srila Prabhupada, but also he is very much chosen and indicated by Srila Guru Maharaj himself as in many respects being no less a person than he himself, and he said so. So this is Anyway, something I'll end here, and then I'll answer that question about the... Rather, I'll let Maharaj answer the question, since it was about the six different whips, and I might mispronounce some of the Sanskrit words and give a whole opposite idea of what they are. I'll let Maharaj answer that question.
You can ask all those things.
So, we find lust,
tama,
anger,
krodha,
greed,
lobha,
madness,
moda,
illusion,
moha,
and envy,
matsarya.
Those are the six whips. And the you said that these different whips, lust, anger, greed, madness, illusion, and envy, they're existing with the conditioned soul, and they are like masters for him. He is serving them. And although he serves them his whole life, they are ungrateful masters. They will not give him any relief. They are not satisfied by his service. They are not saying, oh, you've worked like a lackey your whole life serving me, so now I'll give you some reward. No, they're very ungrateful masters. But those are the whips. By whips, you can understand whips of the conditioned soul. That's what keeps him, conditioned, keeps him driven on in this material world. You have a question about that?
She also asked, why are they in that order?
Why are they
in that order? And how can we get free from them?
Well, how? Why are they in that order? Lust, anger, and greed in particular, they are mentioned as in the Gita as being the enemies of the soul. Arjuna, at one point, speaking of lust, Arjuna says, why is a man driven to act even against his own interest, in even knowing better? And Sri Krishna says that it is lust only, the all-devouring enemy of the soul. So, he explains that by contemplation of the objects of the senses, that attachment forms, then lust, and when one is unable to satisfy that lust, then anger arises. So lust, then anger. And as for the exact order, I can understand how lust goes to anger, then greed and madness, envy, madness, illusion, envy. I can't specify myself why they're in that order, whether of greater or less importance, etc. But you can perceive what they are and how they can make one, chain to this world. And what was the part about how can one become freed from them? Well, there's one verse in the Bhagavad Gita where Krishna says to Daiviyesha gurumayi mama maya duratyaya man eva ye prapadyante mayamitam tarantite. He said this illusory atmosphere known as maya or illusion, which incorporates all those six elements, he says it's divine in the sense that it's working under my control. We want, as stated that reference to Milton, better to reign in hell than to serve in heaven. That is the philosophy of this world. So to help us enjoy the sense of being the lords of this world, Maya comes to make us forget God and his service. But that illusion itself is subordinate to the Lord, as everything is subordinate to the Lord. So Krishna explained that when the living entity no longer desires to live in the atmosphere of exploitation in this world, no longer wants to continue being an exploitive agent, you can say, then he surrenders to the Lord and the Lord releases him from that energy, that illusion.
Maharaj, you both spoke on this point of how the common religion is fear of God, but what we're trying to learn is the path of love of God or dedication. But it seems even in the early stages of bhakti, the principle of fear is common also. We understand the law of karma. So we're scared of committing physical activities because there'll be some dreadful reaction. And in the Srimad Bhagavatam, there are very frightening descriptions of different planets, or even we're scared of living a human form of life.
We
don't utilize this life properly.
Bhaktivinoda Thakur also addresses that issue in that commentary on the Bhagavad. He says that the actual, you know, a lot of these descriptions, for instance, that are in Srimad Bhagavatam, he says, are there because the Bhagavatam is all-inclusive. It's like a compendium, he says, of all, you know, of all thought, of all aspects of what you would call both spiritual and cultural thought. So they're included as, you know, they're part of the whole spectrum. But your question is very good, because although these descriptions are there of the fear of karma, the fear of losing this valuable human birth, etc., although those things are there, still there would have to be more than that to you know, and Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami says very clearly that what really what Mahaprabhu comes to give and what attracts Mahaprabhu himself is loving devotion, and not of a what do they call it, garden store variety. What is it? You know, what would that? You know, not just by rote or by memory, you know, but actually of living faith.
Not mechanical.
Not just, you know, the rules and regulations, and I'm going to memorize this, and I'm now, you know, a big Brahmin, or as my friend here put it the other day, a smarta malecha. Which I thought, you know, what that means is those who are born in kind of like caste families in India who are very, very good at rituals, you know, they're called smarta Brahmins. But we are not from India, we're from the West. And in the West, the people are said, you know, meat eaters, they're called malechas. But some devotees have graduated from the category of malechas of their birth, and they become very doctrinaire in their presentation of so-called Brahmanism. So they have become smart to malechas. You know. But we're not interested in that, and we're not interested in all these kind of rituals that you know exactly. I mean, there's so many details, you know, that someone is, you know, very adept in, you know, how he can tie his dhoti or everything like that, you know. Although there aren't so many dhotis, you know, external things. But what we're really interested in is not just the dress, not just the habits, and not just the fear of karma and all that, but we're actually interested in
the substance.
And that's why Guru Maharaj said, I'm a form breaker, not a form maker. He didn't mean that like as a, he wasn't like a threatening anybody or any organization. He was simply indicating that, you know, we're not just interested in appearances, we're interested in substance. The soul is substance and the body is form. We're interested in the soul and not just the body. So ultimately, as I said, the real faith of the soul is that of loving devotion. And that you can find in the words of the saints and in the real, and the, what are the scriptures? Ultimately, the scriptures are the words of the saints also. So with the help of a real revolutionary, reformist, whatever word you want to use, saint will say, then you can get the gist of what is real faith. You know, your faith, if you have faith, your faith will take you into the association of them, and it will continue to grow, and that same faith will become love of God. And so as you've said, you know, you're all the different fears that people may have, I'm going to lose this human birth and all that kind of, you know, tripe. I'm not going to call it tripe, actually. It's part of preaching. But it's not really just the essence. The essence is love. So that can be knowledge, and knowledge ultimately can surrender itself at the feet of bhakti. Yeah?
Can I just say that quality in devotional service should never be quantity.
Compromised.
Compromised, yeah.
The last bit again?
Would you say, Maharaj, that quality should be the important aspect in devotional service?
The question is, would we say that quality should be given preference over quantity in devotional service? Yeah. Is that what your question was? Yeah.
That quantity should not
compromise quality. Sure. Not only in devotional service, in anything. Because quality is the stuff that we're made of. And quantity may be desirable for some in certain areas and at certain circumstances. It may be desirable at certain stages and within certain circumstances. But not to be so general to the point of being blasé. In other words, quality still remains necessary from the beginning to the end, because a large quantity of defective quality will take us in the wrong direction. It's fine to be on the right path, but we should be at least facing the right direction. Anyway, in general, it's probably some people would chastise you and say, isn't that obvious? But still, if the question arises, we should respect that too.
I was more just about, you know, could you comment more on that aspect?
Yeah. Yes, I could. Generally, it's a matter which has been, I'll come to you, which has been mentioned in the respect of chanting the holy name. Maybe that's most interesting to the devotees present. I think everyone present is a devotee in their own way. In other words, if we are told to chant a large number of names, a counted number of names, we count that chanting on beads, etc. That was stressed in the beginning, and very few even managed to fulfill that quantity. Later, now at this present time, we're being urged to chant with quality rather than quantity at the expense of the quality. Had we not been urged to chant the quantity in the earlier stages, we may not have had the opportunity of become accustomed or habituated, for want of better words, to the practice itself, and we would have had greater opportunity to fall to the prey of the weakness and leave the matter altogether. Many did do that. However, to have a timely instruction to concentrate on the quality of that chanting of the name gives us the chance to have a more substantial penetration, a deeper penetration into the touch of divinity. Do you follow? And that's where we find that to avoid the offenses to the name and the real gist of Vaishnavism needs to be taught at a stage beyond indoctrination as such. A mechanical indoctrination can leave us with nothing. But a deeper entrance with regard to quality will save us from that formal indoctrination, which is a very flimsy introduction to the true practices of devotion. But still an introduction is always necessary. So the stress on the